This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you guys doing? Welcome to the third lesson of propositional logic, where we go through some of the most important rules that you need to know for logical reasoning. And we have been trying to, you know, cover obviously what you would cover in the basics of L1 logic, by mixing as well some of the things that we'd be studying if you did a bit of usul fiqh, or for example, if you did, we're going to go through it today, but a little bit of balagh as well, rhetoric. You'd be surprised. Like we said, and I think it's important to repeat this point, we actually said that it's almost impossible to completely divorce logic in a full sense from all of the other kinds of disciplines and subject matters. So a lot of L1 logic, if you're studying mathematics, especially discrete mathematics, you will study some of the things that we were talking about today. If a discrete mathematics course will cover a lot of this stuff. A computer engineering course will cover all this stuff. But what's even more interesting maybe for a student of knowledge from the Islamic perspective is that Arabic rhetoric actually absorbs a lot of the logical rules as well, al-balagha. Like one of the first things you'll learn when you do Arabic rhetoric is the difference between al-khabar wal-insha. Khabar being something which is declarative. Insha is not actually, لا يحتمل الصدق والكذب, they will say. لا يحتمل الصدق والكذب, or it's not susceptible to true and falsehood. This is in a rhetoric book. So you open up an Arabic grammar book, or we can say an Arabic rhetoric book, and this is the first thing that you'll be confronted with, or one of the first things you'll be confronted with. But where does this come from? It comes directly from the words of Aristotle. In fact, he wrote a book called the Organon. I'm not sure if you've come across it, but it's an important book, where he kind of delineates some of these logical principles and talks about some of these things. But there's a kind of cross-pollination of things. And if someone says, well, for the sake of argument, it's haram to study logic. Haram, or it's not allowed. Yeah, as some have said, and some do still continue to say, then is it haram to study that aspect of rhetoric? Because I don't see why you haven't made that fatwa. Because a big chunk of rhetoric, Arabic rhetoric, is pure logic. A big chunk of usul fiqh is pure logic. A big chunk of mathematics is pure. So why don't you make the fatwa against these things as well? But of course, you'd have to go and see, these are the things that are haram and these are the things that are halal, or this one's okay because it's part of this, and it becomes a confusing fatwa, to say the least. Having said that, today, to try and clear the confusion, we're going to just interleave and summarize some of the things we have said in the first session and the second session. The second session was particularly important because we went over two very common kind of like logical fallacies, yeah, and they're connected somehow to two proper way of doing things from a logical perspective. Let's start with the proper way of doing things. So modus ponens, let's drill this as we would usually. What is modus ponens? If P, then what?
Q.
All right, then
what's
P, therefore
Q.
Okay, what logical fallacy is most closely associated with this form?
Isn't affirming the consequent?
All right, so affirming the consequent, okay. Which one is the antecedent and which one is the consequent? This is what?
Antecedent.
And which one is this?
Consequent.
All right, yeah, the consequent. So how would we affirm the consequent? How would this be wrong? How would you make this is the correct form? So
yes,
let me rub this out maybe, yeah? If this is the correct form, this is modus ponens.
Should it not be modus tollens? If P, then Q, not Q.
Well, I mean, that's another thing. Well, let's start with this first, yeah, right? Because okay. You said that what's connected to this. If P, then Q. Okay, so you have the antecedent and you have the consequence. Now you have the antecedent, therefore you have the consequent, yeah?
Yeah.
So, okay, affirming the consequent, what would have to come before what? How would this work?
The fallacy would be Q, therefore P.
Okay, so how would it sound out, the whole thing?
If yeah? Q, then
if no no no
or if P
then Q,
yeah,
then what?
if P then Q, Q then yes. before P.
That is affirming the consequent. You're doing the opposite of what should be done. Yeah. Ha, you see what I mean? Q, therefore P. Now this is called affirming the consequent. Because you've jumped the gun. You've said, okay, if P, then Q. Okay, so if you're saying if P, then Q, right? What you're effectively saying, if this condition is actualized, then this result would ensue. If I take the sleeping tablet, I go to sleep. If I take the sleeping tablet, I'll go to sleep. Okay, so which comes before which? Taking the sleeping tablet or the sleep? Taking the sleeping tablet. So if I take the sleeping tablet, I've got horrible examples, but just bear with me. I'm just making it on the spot, shorthand. You know, if I take the sleeping tablet, I'm going to go to sleep. I take the sleeping tablet, therefore what happens? I go to sleep. But affirming the consequent would say what? If I take the sleeping tablet, I go to sleep. Then you'll say what afterwards?
I go to sleep,
therefore I take the sleeping tablet. It doesn't follow. You see, you're affirming the consequent. You're inversing the relationship as should be. This is a consequence. This is a fallacy. Now, the fallacy of, and this is very important to note this and to remember this, the fallacy of affirming the consequent is related to modus ponens. Why? Because it's jumbling, if you like, the normal structure. If P then Q, Q therefore P, that's wrong. It should be P therefore Q, yeah? It should be P therefore Q. Okay, now what is the other one?
Denying the antecedent.
All right, and what's that connected with?
Modus tollens.
So what is modus tollens?
So modus tollens is if P, then Q, not Q.
Okay, one second. If P,
then Q.
Then Q. So we start in exactly the same fashion as we did before. Okay. That's number one. Then what happens after?
Then we negate the Q.
Then we negate the Q. Okay, so we're negating what? The consequent or the antecedent?
Consequent.
Yeah. So we're negating this. Therefore what?
Therefore not P.
Is this good or is this bad? Is this valid? Good. Okay, excellent. So how do I make this wrong? What is...
Denying the antecedent, so not P in the second...
So tell me how this would look.
So if P, then Q, yes. Not P... Therefore, not Q.
Okay. So, if P, then Q, you're saying not P. Therefore, not Q. So, what you've done is you've done the opposite. Right? So, you're saying if P, then Q, not P, therefore not Q, you've effectively jumbled 2 and 3. Why is this problematic? Let's go back to the sleeping tablets thing. Okay, how do I, or some, give me your own example. I mean, how does this...
So, an example would be...
Go on, yeah.
So...
I mean, I've got the bad examples. Yeah.
If you are pious, then you pray 5 times a day.
Yeah.
The correct version would be, is that you do not pray 5 times a day.
Beautiful.
Or you are not pious.
Beautiful. I like this example. That's excellent, yeah? So, you don't pray 5 times a day. That's what makes you not pious.
Yeah.
But if I say it wrong now, what would I say?
So then, incorrectly, it would be if you are pious, then you pray 5 times. You are not pious, therefore you do not pray.
Exactly.
But you could be, you could pray and still be. I mean, sorry, I've confused myself.
No, but you're right.
Yeah.
But obviously, there's one way out of this with the whole praying example. Someone could argue this is valid. Mm. But it's not true because it's actually a reciprocal relationship. And what do we call that? What kind of situation is this when it's reciprocity?
It's like related to a sufficient condition, biconditional.
Biconditional.
Yeah.
Excellent. So how would the biconditional look like? A biconditional it looks like it's represented in the following manner. You have P and Q. Yeah. P what Q?
What's the
equals, yeah. Or you can put a thing like that, yeah. Right? So you could say, you could argue, because obviously, fine, you're right. But if you don't pray 5 times a day, you're not pious. But if you, it's reciprocal because you, if you pray 5 times a day, you become pious. and you're pious if you pray five times a day. Someone could argue it's a biconditional relationship. Mm-hmm. Now you both got legitimate forms. What are you going to be fighting on? You're going to be justifying your premises now. Both of you are going to be saying, oh, you're more likely to be right because of this. And you're more likely to be right because of this. Which shows us a very important thing. Not every valid argument is true. But every true argument is what? Valid. Now, we've already covered this stuff, but it's good to just refresh our memories. But on the issue of validity, okay, having a sound argument even is not the only condition, we said. Because you can have a sound argument, it's true, fine, no problem. But let's say you have an invalid argument, yes? Having an invalid argument doesn't mean what you're saying is it unsound. Because your argument could be invalid, but what you're saying could be true.
Meaning the final conclusion could be true.
You could be saying something in an invalid form.
Okay.
Some say, okay, well, I'm making an argument. It's an invalid form. But the conclusion is a true statement. Does that make sense? So validity, if something is invalid, it doesn't mean that the argument is false. It doesn't mean that the statement is untrue.
Yeah.
You can make a series of statements in an invalid way, but what you're saying, although you're saying it in a wrong way, is true. Is inductively true. You can make a false syllogism, for example, which has got invalid premise, conclusion, or whatever. But actually, the conclusion is a matter of fact. What can't be true, and this segues nicely into today's session, is what? What cannot be true?
A contradiction.
Now, I don't want to go into this. Some definitions of a contradiction is something which cannot be true in any possible world. This, we're not going to go into this. Yeah? Modal definitions and stuff. We're going to stay with the propositional basics. And by the way, in propositional logic, Aristotelian logic and Arabic logic, or you can call it Islamicate logic, because the reason why I want to call it Arabic logic is because it was written in Arabic and Persian. Like, the Islamic Empire had two strong languages in the Abbasid times, which it was being used all the time. Arabic language, Persian language. Okay, and then after that, obviously, the Turkish language, the Ottoman Empire and all that kind of stuff. But it's not fair to call it Arabic, because that's why I say call it Islamicate, because it includes everybody. And don't forget, the majority of the scholars were actually Persian. Yeah, and if you look at the Muhaddis, for instance, the only one I think who was Arab was Muslim. You know, of the six books of Hadith, there was one Arab guy. All the other guys were unknown Arabs. At-Tirmidhi, Nisa'i, all of those guys. Or Al-Ghazali, obviously he wrote this. Ibn Sina, all these guys were Persians. Well, at least they were writing in that language. And they knew how to write Arabic as well. But anyway, so Islamicate thing, we're going to talk about the conditions of contradiction, okay? And they're usually eight conditions. But before we get to that, Aristotle has a very specific definition of a contradiction, which he writes in his works, which, if I might get it out, but from my memory, is something which cannot be true in any respect. And we'll talk about what you mean by any respect. But let me get exactly what he said to make sure that it is possible that the same thing can at the same time belong and not belong to the subject in the same respect. Now, this in the same respect must be outlined. So I'm going to write down his definition, Aristotle's definition. I think it's a pretty good definition. There are other definitions like a compound which is true and not true at the same, a compound sentence which is true and not true at the same time. And it has a form, but let's stick with one thing at a time. So we'll stick with Aristotle's definition. I think it's a pretty good definition. So Aristotle is saying the following, yeah? He is saying it is impossible that the same thing can at the same time both belong. And not belong. To the same object. There's a lot of things going on here. We're going to break it down, yeah? In the same respect. Okay, now, this is the definition. It's important for you to, I'll give you a little bit of time just to write that down. But in logic, propositional logic, you have a tautology. Okay, a tautology, do you remember how it's represented? Like this, with a T, yeah? T is, it's always true. A tautology is always true. A contradiction, you know, in symbolic format, is actually the opposite, like this. Because a contradiction is always false. That's, and what follows from a contradiction is something called the law of implosion, by the way. The law of implosion is that anything follows from a contradiction. Which means if you wanna make a contradictory statement, anything follows. Even Leibniz, very interestingly, he said you can explain everything in the world with two things. The principle of non-contradiction and the principle of sufficient reason. Everything can be explained with just two things. And we're going to cover something called the proof by contradiction. Very interesting, which is really the equivalent. In discrete mathematics, you have something called proof by contradiction. And that is the equivalent to something called reductio ad absurdum or a reductio ad impossible. It's a reductio argument. A reductio argument is basically what we said. You try and prove the opposite of the thing, and therefore you prove the thing itself. So, for example, let me cover that first, I think. It's pretty easy, yeah? Slow-laying fruit. If I try and cover the following statement, I'm going to give you some juice here, okay? And this is going to be very, very applicable, okay? If I try and say the following thing, I want to prove P, okay? How do I prove P? I try and prove P by proving not P, actually. So now this is called reductio ad absurdum. I'm proving P, well, let's just say, for the sake of argument, I'm proving Q by showing not P. I'm proving Q by showing not P. Do you see what I'm saying here? Okay, so how does this actually take place? I'm doing this by taking it through a proof. And I'll give you a very famous example. One that obviously, where's my book? Well, I might as well be shameless here. I've mentioned in my book, yeah? I've mentioned in my book. And this is the classical arguments, you know, of God's existence. A lot of the contingency arguments are based on the following. You say, Gottfried Leibniz, for instance, he puts this in a very explicit manner. He says, let's assume God doesn't exist. So this is, in this case, let's put juice to this. Let's put flesh on meat. He says, not P here is the equivalent of God not existing. God doesn't exist. I'm not going to write the whole thing, okay? Some people are going to be happy. You get some screenshots. You get some screenshots and say, look, the guy, he's joined the dark side, you know? So let's just say God doesn't, let's call it atheism, right? So not P is the atheistic worldview. Not P, God doesn't exist. Now, what contradiction, this is the question, what contradiction takes place if we assume not P? Now, that is where the fight is. What contradiction? So Gottfried Leibniz says the following. He says, look, you can't have a world with only contingent things. And this is exactly what Ibn Sina said, is mostly what people in society, in the history of the philosophy of religion have said. Less, they've used this kind of an argumentation. They said, let's assume God doesn't exist. Why is it problematic? Because you can't have a world of just contingent things. Why not? Now, different scholars come to different conclusions, but they're all using the same proof by contradiction, effectively proof by contradiction type argumentation. Now, if you remember in the very first thing, we weren't filming this, but we spoke about the infinite regress. The infinite regress, we said, Al-Ghazali makes the following argument. He makes it very clearly. He says it assumes two things at the same time, which are contradictory. What do you remember? Do you remember what it is? Let me tell you. It assumes that the inexhaustible has been exhausted. So the inexhaustible has been exhausted. Now, what do we mean by that? We mean, if there is an actual infinity of real things in the real world, what does infinity mean? He would say, infinity means, yes, for instance, that there is boundless things or limitless things or unlimited things, yeah? So if you have a point, which is now, this point in time, which is now, assumes that the inexhaustible has been exhausted. And that is a contradiction. And it fulfills all of the conditions of a contradiction. Because these are opposite things. A contradiction must be in conflict with each other. By everyone's definition, in a propositional sense, in a modal sense, in an Aristotelian sense, everyone agrees this proposition is contradictory. That the inexhaustible has been exhausted. You are saying P and not P at the same time. That is what you are saying. A contradiction, one way of understanding a contradiction, is you're saying P and not P at the same time. It's a conjunctive phrase. With selb and ijab, or affirmation and negation in the same compound. That's really what a contradiction is. A contradiction is when you put two things which are in conflict or in conflict with one another and you put them in a conjunctive proposition, a compound. You're saying P and not P at the same time. That's what you're saying. So if you say, well, there can be an infinite regress or an infinite amount of actual things in the real world, Al-Ghazali clearly says, you are saying, and he says this at the Hefidah Philosopher, you are saying that the inexhaustible has been exhausted. And that's a contradiction. So the implication of not P, according to Al-Ghazali, not P being in this case what? The infinite regress. That's the implication. If you have an infinite regress of actual events, then you have the inexhaustible has been exhausted. That's a contradiction. Even in a modal sense, you say that cannot exist in any world because that's impossible. And impossible things cannot exist in any world. That's his argument. And it's a very strong argument, in fact. An untouchable one. So much so that I read a book from Graham Oppy, who he wrote a 295-page book on infinity. He is seen as the leading atheist in the philosophy of religion. And he doesn't have an answer for this question. I can just give you a summary of the book. He does not have an answer for this. And after all this long talking, I'm paraphrasing, he says this concept has perplexed us and we don't really have an answer for it. Basically, an appeal to incredulity. We don't know about it and whatever. This is not incredulous. This is impossible. We are claiming this is impossible. And so Gottfried Leibniz, he makes the same kind of argumentation on this basis. Do you see what I'm saying? He says that let's assume God doesn't exist. What will ensue is a contradiction. Why? Because contingent things, and then he explains them as something which requires an explanation outside of itself. And he has this whole thing. You cannot have a world with just that. The buck must stop. And this is my language. No, this is actually Graham Oppy's language. The buck must stop at what Graham Oppy refers to as a necessary thing. But his way out, he refers to something called the brute contingency, and that's something else we could talk about, which is impossible. It's impossible. It's a contradiction. What is a brute contingency? Anyway, talk about a necessary contingent thing at the same time. So in order to try and solve this problem, the atheists, or the great atheists of our time, have employed contradictory methods. But this is it. You can use arguments or proof by contradiction to prove that the question really is, if God doesn't exist, how can we? That's really it. And that's a very strong argument. It's been used throughout thousands of years of human history. So any questions on the proof of contradiction? So there's two or three things. We have the Aristotelian definition. We have the idea that it's opposite to a tautology. And we also have the idea that it's a compound of P and not P at the same time.
And here we're saying that Q is defined as not P, right? So
they're different. Yeah, they're different. So, okay, so...
I mean, like, there's only two options here.
Yeah. So that's how you're affirming the opposite of the not P. Okay. Now, let's move on. Because it's important to note that in Islamicate... In fact, is this too much or should I continue? Is it okay? Pace okay? Okay. In Islamicate philosophy... or logic, there were eight conditions of a contradiction. There were eight conditions. And if you read Aristotle's definition well, they're all kind of implicated in that definition. And these eight conditions of a contradiction are as follows. And I'm going to mention this. First of all, I'm going to write it like in Arabic and then in English as well. Yes, can I go? I'm going to go this way. They say, first of all, the bog standard definition that you'll find in Akhtari's works and all this, is they say, ikhtilaf. اختلاف القضيتين يا بالإجاب والسلب بحيث يقتضي لذاته الصدق إحداهما وكذب الأخرى. Now this is an interesting definition. I'm going to explain. Qadiyatayn, really, what is a qadiyah? It's a terminological word. It means, in logical terms, really a declarative statement. Yeah. So here it's saying the conflict of two declarative statements. In such a way statements in affirmation or negation, so this goes to P and not P. We said P or not P, you cannot have both at the same time. In affirmation or negation, in such a manner that would entail the truth of one and the falsehood, let's just say, or falsity. I think falsity sounds a bit better. Let's take it out. Falsity. Of the other. What does this mean? It means you have two statements being made, which means you have two things, a compound. There are some things, according to Aristotle, according to Islamic logic, and according to the aql, common sense, which cannot be a contradiction. And this is why I said in the very beginning of the session, I said if you study Arabic rhetoric, which is a branch of grammar, sorry, a branch of Arabic studies, Arabic is divided into three, effectively, tasrif or sarf, morphology, rhetoric and nahw, grammar. Okay, if you study rhetoric, that one of the first things they teach you is what's the difference between al-khabar wal-insha, a declarative statement, and an insha, or a kind of, I can't even translate insha because it has like five or six different categories. A non-declarative, let's just call it non-declarative statement. Yeah, so you have a declarative statement, which is yahtamilu sidq wal-kadhib, that the statement itself, is susceptible to being true or false. Whereas an insha is لا يحتمل الصدق والكذب لذاته. It doesn't actually, it's not susceptible to being proven or disproven. So what is a thing that cannot be, and they've got five different divisions, bitsa, ni'ma, and dizna. But one of them is, a ta'ajjub is another one, being amazed of something, Because being amazed doesn't, it's not actually a declarative state of affairs. One of the things which لا يحتمل الصدق والكذب لذاته is a question, سؤال. So, يعني, it was mentioned, Aristotle's book, it's mentioned the books of grammar and so on, or rhetoric. If I ask you a question, I can't be right or wrong about this question. يعني, I can't ask a question and then you say, that's wrong. Effectively, technically speaking, there cannot be a wrong question. Cannot be invalid, يعني, in the sense as well. You can have a question with an incorrect presupposition. You can have a contradictory presupposition. But you cannot have a question which is contradictory in and of itself. Because a question doesn't have, it's not susceptible to contradiction from that perspective. That's why asking questions is one of the safest things you can do in a debate. Because no one can say to you, look, that's wrong. We say, what do you mean that's wrong? Can say, well, it's an assumption. Your assumptions are wrong. But you cannot say my question is wrong. I have questions that I'm asking. How can you tell me my questions are wrong? I am not even making a statement from a declarative perspective. How could it be, what is it wrong from what perspective? Is it invalid? It's a question. Is it wrong because it entails or it is a contradiction? How could it be a contradiction when it's not a compound of P and not P? It's not, it cannot be a contradiction from that perspective. But if I ask, can God lift a rock so create a rock so heavy that it can't lift? It's not a wrong question. But the question is, has a wrong assumption or a contradictory assumption. What is the contradictory assumption? That such a thing, such a rock can exist. Or like if I say, can the eternal one have a beginning? It's a good question, but it assumes the that is a possible state of affairs, the possibility of such state of affairs. You see, there's an assumption in the question. So I can say the assumption is flawed, but that's the furthest I can take it with a question. A declarative statement, really, if you're making a combination of declarative statements, they're going to be right or wrong depending on how they come together, okay? So we said this is a bog standard definition in the books of logic, yeah, of what a contradiction is. And you can see it's effectively telling you where you have a state of affairs of P and not P are there. Because Selb and Ijab, affirmation and declaration, negation. Where those two things are compounded, you have a contradiction. But they take it further. So are you guys okay with this? I'm going to rub it out because there's more to be said. They take it further by saying, look, there's eight conditions of a contradiction. And the eight conditions of a contradiction is the following. And look, a lot of this stuff is kind of commonsensical. But do you know what? To be honest, it's useful. And it's not in the books of predicate logic or even propositional logic. It's in the book of Islamicate logic. And I thought it's a good introduction to have. Because I swear to God, people make these mistakes all the time. People claim there's contradictions because they don't understand these eight conditions. But if you understand the eight conditions, then you don't have the problem. If I say, for instance, the first one is that it has to be the same subject matter. موضوع, in Arabic it's called موضوع, yeah? So if I say Ali is standing up, and I say Osman is not standing up, a fool might say, this is a contradiction. Say, well, we're not talking about the same thing here, guys. I mean, we might be using the same language, okay? But we certainly are not speaking about the same thing. Okay, so that one, everyone should be okay with. So the first one is subject matter, okay? The second one is the same predicate. And this is called mahmul. So if I say Zayd is qa'im, Actually, this is exactly the same example. I need to give another example. Let's say Zayd is jealous. Okay, Zayd is sitting down. Okay. And then I say, no, Abu Bakr is dancing. I mean, it's two different situations completely. The predicate is different even, yeah? We have Zayd here, we have Abu Bakr here. It's a completely different situation. Okay? All right. This is the second condition. The third and fourth conditions are very, very easy, which is makan and zaman, basically. Place and time. Place and time. If I say, I mean, actually, I'm saying too many things. This is an easy one. What do you guys reckon with place and time?
Usman is in England. Ali is in France.
Okay, but let's stay with time. Yeah, there's verse in the Quran that talk about the Day of Judgment, and some of the fools, they say, well, in the Quran, you know, the Day of Judgment, you said no one's going to speak. But in another verse, it says they will say this. What's going on here? Isn't this a contradiction? Ibn Abbas said, well, actually, the Day of Judgment is how long?
Over 500 years.
50,000 years. يَوْمًا كَانَ مِقَدَارُهُ 50,000 سَنَةً As the Quran says, right? 50,000 years. طيب. So in 50,000 years, couldn't there be a time where people are speaking and some time where they're not speaking? There's a time where this one, that one. And of course, there's a time for this and that. If I say, I'm in a police interrogation, and the officer comes in with all pomp and arrogance, and he says, what were you doing on Tuesday? I said, I woke up and started eating breakfast, you know. And then he went out, and he came back, and he said, so what were you doing on Tuesday? I said, I was watching dinner, I was watching EastEnders. I said, but you said you were doing breakfast. There's a contradiction now. Now you're an unreliable person. I said, you said Tuesday. You didn't say at what time. And Tuesday is 24 hours. I could have been doing lots of things in that time. Unless you don't know the basics of logic. In which case, I recommend you to the Sapiens course. Do you know what I mean? Because you can have differing things, things which are in conflict. No problem. So long as it's in different times. If I say, look, I mean, I went to this place and I went to that place. Where are you? I'm in London. And then you call later on, I say, where are you? I'm in that place. Or he's in this place. And that one, like you said, no problem. That person's in this place and that other person's in that place. Where are the Chinese people? And I say, the Chinese people are in Morocco and the Chinese people are in Japan. And the Chinese people are in this place or that. I say, oh, it's a contradiction. How could they be in so many different places? So because there's so many of them. And this, what's the problem? So something can be in more than one place and fulfill conflicting functions, do differing things. And they can be in different times based on the... Yani, it's common sense in really and truly. Any questions on this? It's pretty simple, huh? Pretty simple thing, yeah?
For the second one, can you give an example where the subject matter stays the same?
With the time or place?
No, the second example.
Same predicate. Second contradiction.
Second condition.
Oh, you want us to go back?
Yeah.
We'll come back. Let's just finish all the eight, and then we'll go back. So is everyone okay with these conditions so far? Okay. The next ones is what they say in relation to a thing. Idafa means what you add to something else. Okay? So the next one is al-idafa, right? But then it depends on what... So in relation to something. If I say... look, idafa, this is Arabic grammar effectively, right? Idafa, you have mudaf and you have mudaf ilayh. Idafa means... it should be like this. Idafa, yeah? It means... It's a relational thing. It means in relation to, yeah? Usually it's when you add one thing to another, effectively. Yudif means to add something to something else, okay? So in relation to one thing. So I could be a father in relation to my son, but I'm a son in relation to my father. So a fool could say, well, how could you be a father and a son at the same time? I say, I'm a father in relation to my son and a son in relation to my father. This is fine. And you can see how the Trinitarians may say, okay, now you understand. But no, because they're not saying in relation to anything. They're saying he is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. He's not the Father only in relation to the Son and the Son in relation to the Holy Spirit. No, they're saying they're making a claim. But the Father in relation to the Son and the Son in relation to the Father. Now, if I say, can you be a father and a son at the same time? You can be a father and a son at the same time from one perspective. From one perspective, which is a relational perspective. In other words, so long as there is relationships that you have, which means that there is no one state that you need to be in, effectively, in all times. I'll come to a lot of the discussion of nominalism, which is connected to this. Because someone will say, there's no such thing as fatherhood anyway. I mean, someone could say, a nominalist could say, fatherhood doesn't exist in a substrate. Fatherhood is not there, Yani. It's just, the concept of fatherhood is just an imposition. It's something we put. But fatherhood doesn't actually exist, someone could argue. But the relationship, you could say father in relation to the son, son in relation to the father. Okay, that's not a contradictory statement at all, Yani. Does that make sense so far? And there's another thing which is bil quwwa and bil fi'l. So what number was that? Was that number 5 or number 6?
Number 4.
No, it couldn't be number 4, was it?
Yeah, same subject matter, predicate, place, time.
We've got place and time are two.
Okay,
yeah.
Two different ones. Yeah. Yes, one, two.
So is it number 5?
This is number 6 now.
This is number 6.
Yeah.
All right, so number 6 now, we've got another thing. They say bil quwwa and bil fi'l. And it really is potential and actual. Bil fi'l is and bil quwwa. There's two things, bil fi'l and bil quwwa. So, I may have the potential to do something, but I might not do it. For example, say, look, Osman can write, can read and write, but he's not reading and writing. So, how can you do something but he's not doing it? Well, he has the potential, the quwwa, if you like, the ability, the capability. Having the capability to do something is not the same as doing it. So for example, this comes in some of the Aqidah discussions. You say, well, if you've heard this, you might think this is so basic. Why would anyone challenge this? This is one of the arguments some Christian apologists use. Say, if God is loving, who did he have to love? He had to have a Trinity so he can always love somebody. You know what I mean? Now you might think this is a bad argument. It is a bad argument. Because if you put someone in a desert island, okay, and he's a loving person, I'm a kind and compassionate person, okay? You put me in a desert island, there's no object that I need to love. I don't need to love anybody, right? Yet, have I lost my ability to love? Have I stopped being a loving person because I'm on a desert island? I haven't stopped being a loving person. If you put me on a desert island, I'll still be compassionate. I'll be loving, but I just have the ability to do it, the capability. I'm not actualizing that behavior. It's not a contradiction. You say, well, if you don't have an object where you can do the thing to, therefore you're not that thing. That's false. And I don't want to talk about Ibn Taymiyyah's discussion on the issue of Khalaq and Khaliq. But he doesn't make this irrational argument, but He makes an argument that if God is al-Khalaq and he always creates, and that he says morphologically the word Khalaq means to always create, therefore he had to always create. Someone may say then, in response to Ibn Taymiyyah, but Allah is Ghaffar, and it's on the same wazn. I'm responding to Ibn Taymiyyah. I say, well, if Allah is Khalaq, therefore he had to always create. Allah is also Ghaffar, which means he had to always, what? Forgive. Which means, according to Ibn Taymiyyah's view, you could argue one of the entailments is there had to be some other life forms out there. There had to be some aliens there that Allah was forgiving. Maybe that's an entailment of Ibn Taymiyyah's view. Because I'm not saying what he said, he never said there's aliens, Ibn Taymiyyah. I'm saying if you're saying it's Allah's Khalaq because he's always creating, the potential must translate always into actual, and you're using it, yeah, to say that Allah's Khalaq, then I can say, well, Allah Ghaffar, he must always be forgiving, and therefore there must be an object of forgiveness all the time. So you'll be surprised, this distinction, Al-Quwwa and Al-Fi'l, or the capability of potential, the ability to do something, and the actualizing it, this distinction is important in Aqidah studies. And you can see that this distinction stops people from making contradictions, especially with the sifat of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Of course, Ibn Taymiyyah has a very long discussion just he has a whole sharh of the hadith of كان الله ولم يكن شيء معه وكان عرشه على الماء. It's Imran Hussein's hadith. He's talking about Allah was there and there's nothing with him, and his arsh was on the water. He says, well, actually, the arsh, the throne of Allah, was on the water, which means the water was there, which means this and which means that. And you can say it's convincing, or you can say it's not convincing. But he does argue the matter from a logical perspective, and to know these concepts is important because now you can engage with these theological discussions. That was number 7, right?
Yep.
And number 8 is in conditionality. So, for example, you can say Ali is successful if he studies, yeah? Now, you can't say, well, he's successful if he studies and he's successful if he doesn't study at the same time. Yani, you cannot say he is successful if he studies and then say, well, actually, he's successful if he doesn't study as well. Does that make sense? This is a contradictory statement. You cannot condition two things which are opponent, because then you go back to P and not P. P plus not P, which is a contradiction. So this is the last, these are the 8 conditions of a contradiction. Now, I want you to, speaking with the person next to you, yes?
Ask a question. About the last one. The last one, is it based on the definition? So if we say, Ali is a Muslim, if he drinks alcohol, Ali is a Muslim, if he doesn't drink alcohol, then is it just semantics when we're talking about what it means to be a Muslim? Is that...
No, but you're making contradictory statements here.
Yeah.
You're making contradictory statements, then you're confusing the person. You're saying things which are false, Yani.
From like an Islamic theological perspective, you're committing a sin, but you're not outside the fold of Islam.
So we go back to Halbach. Where's the book? Halbach, remember what he said here, and this is actually quite important. Halbach says the following about contradictions. Let me just get it for you, because I think it's okay. But actually, let's say categorization of consistency, because in a sense, he says, look, a set of sentences is logically consistent if and only if there is at least one interpretation under which all sentences of the set are true.
Okay.
So remember, this is quite important, because we may be making sentences which you can interpret. Like I said, these 8 conditions, okay, in a way is showing you how the interpretation can be true, because you can look at it. For example, what's not mentioned here, which you can also mention, is the part and the whole. I say, for instance, this book is bad. Chapter 8 is bad. Chapter 8 of this book is not no good. But the book is good. Now, these two sentences are contradictory, but I'm talking about part of the book and then a whole of the book. Yani, there's, so long as you can find one interpretation, if I say this book is bad, this book is good, if I can find a contextual... sarif, or something, a contextual marker, which indicates that I'm talking about two different things in two different contexts, then you can make excuses for contradictions. Part and whole, time and place, conditionality and non-conditionality, relational situations, whatever it may be. If you cannot find an interpretation, that's where there is a contradiction. If I say I exist and I don't exist, this is a contradiction. Now, a skeptic may say, look, I exist and I don't exist at the same time. P and not P at the same time. A compound contradiction. I accept this. Then what do we have? The law of implosion. Anything follows from a contradiction. Yani, if someone is willing to accept a contradiction, logically speaking, this is a law. Anything follows. You can say whatever you like. Now, you can say whatever you like. I don't even want to speak to you anymore. you know what I mean? If I say, look, do you accept that the inexhaustible can be exhausted? And he says, I accept it. So you accept the contrary, you accept P and not P. Yes, I accept it. I can't, the conversation is done. Now things have to get physical for you to understand. if you do not learn, you must feel. I mean, what can I say? Now it has to go from Ayn al-Yaqeen. So it has to go from Haqq al-Yaqeen to Ayn al-Yaqeen. That's it, it's done now. Because if you're willing to accept a contradiction, that's the conversation is finished. But what I'm saying is, so long as somebody is able to find an interpretation where the contradiction doesn't apply, the Trinity doesn't afford you. The thing is, I want to just make a point here. Both atheism and the Trinity contain contradictions. That's the problem. Polytheism and atheism, Christianity, the other alternative, the other proselytizing religion in the world, the evangelizing religion in the world apart from Islam, that's saying to the people, come and be me. Come and be me. We welcome you. It contains a pure contradiction. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Father is God, the Son is God, and the Holy Spirit is God. That's a it is a pure contradiction. Because the subject matter is the same. The God, you're talking about God. It's not all about relational. No, it's not relational. You are saying is God. God has a meaning and it has a form. That's it, or a definition. Khalas, you've contradicted yourself. The atheist will say contingent things can exist ad infinitum, or infinite actualities. You contradict yourself. Live with it. Endure it. Live with that. Do you know what I mean? A polytheist must contradict. That's why Islam, لَوَجِدُ فِيهِ اخْتِلَافًا كَثِيرًا. That's the Quran says they would have found any contradictions. It's the only religion which actually even, that I know of, yani, which makes the challenge. And isn't it powerful that, yani, that Islam even makes that challenge? It's the only religion where the book is saying that if this has been from other than God, it would have been in many contradictions. And I spoke to Bart Ehrman, you know, famous Bart Ehrman, yeah? Who wrote this about it. He says, well, I'm not really convinced, but you know, because blah, blah, blah. Because even a phone book, he said, even a phone book has numbers inside of it and that's got no contradictions in there. That's what he said. So I said, what if you remember, if anyone watched that, I used what we said. It's a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient condition, number one. And number two, one of my friends called me and said, his example of the phone book was actually quite a bad example. Because actually, within 1 year, all those numbers would be wrong. Do you know what I mean? After 1 year, there's the phone book, you call the numbers, it's not Bob, it's John. You change your number. So there's ikhtilaf here, a kind of ikhtilaf going on. What I'm saying is Islam is the only religion which stresses that if a religion is to be true, it cannot contain this contradiction. If it's from God, it cannot. It's not saying it's the only thing. The Quran doesn't say, it says, لَوْ كَانَ مِنْ عَنْدِ غَيْرِ اللَّهِ لَوَجْدُ فِيهِ اخْتِلَافًا كَثِيرًا. It doesn't say it's the only prerequisite. I can say two words with no contradiction, I can claim to be a prophet, and that's it. What is that? You're God now? Yeah, I need a prophet. No, you're not a prophet. It's a necessary, but it's not a sufficient condition. But it shows you, subhanAllah, even on the clearest tenets, you can, by identifying what a contradiction is, how to define it, what the conditions of it are, you can do all the da'wah you want to do. Can you see how powerful a contradiction is? So what is a contradiction? P and not P at the same time. You believe in that, I don't believe in that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah?
So, a question.
Can I sit down here? Yeah, go on.
Yeah. So is it not the case that nowadays, like, the new atheists, they basically even deny the definition of contradiction? Like, for example, the cat's in the box, not in the box. You have the
I haven't read that.
Fair enough.
I haven't read that. If they did that, it would be finished. It would be gone.
I mean, they don't say it out loud, but they imply it all the time, don't they?
If they want to go that far, we don't need to doubt them.
You talking about Schrodinger's cat?
Yeah, like Schrodinger's cat, and like, you know, you study in quantum, like they always go on mechanics, and they always bring that topic up.
Great. So the quantum objection, you wouldn't say, like, look, to approach quantum mechanics, they have to have axioms. Those axioms are going to have to be coherent. If they're not coherent, they're not going to be able to even achieve anything. So remember what he said, from a contradiction, anything follows. You can make a falsehood. The Quran says, so in other words, just on the quantum point, what they are missing is the following. You've got a micro theory and then your macro theory. They need a theory of everything, the theory that combines it. They cannot use their incredulity as an evidence. Because we don't have a theory which combines the micro and the macro. Therefore, contradictions can exist in a possible world. Because if you really believe that, the statement that you're making would be, you're trying to be consistent in the statement that you're making. You're trying to use coherence. If you abandon coherence, anything follows. Fine, whatever. Say what you want. Say what you want. The Quran says, لا يأتيه الباطل من بين يديه ولا من خلفه. Very interesting terminology. That falsehood doesn't come to it, i.e. the Quran itself, from before it or after it. In other words, it's truth in all of its interpretations. It's fully true. It's fully true. And you can see now the significance of that. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Any other questions on that? Mm. So what I'll do now is, I'll give you guys 5 minutes. And in whatever way you like to. It's going to be a bit of a difficult, maybe 10 minutes. Difficult task. But using a kind of reductio argument. Use a reductio argument against either polytheism, Christianity, or atheism. You can use whatever reductio argument, but appeal to the idea of a contradiction in the opposite or the alternative. Appeal to the idea that the alternative means a contradiction. So imagine that you're speaking to an atheist now, or a polytheist, or a Christian. Yes, and how would you use what I've just spoken about today with you? How would you use that? You can use some of the examples we gave, but you can just make it your own. To show them that the opposite of, for example, one God entails a contradiction. Just a quick one on the difference between al-mahmul and mawdu'a, yeah? So we said that is roughly translated as subject. This one, I don't want to say object, but in nahu, it's the equivalent of khabar, okay? Which means what? It's, yani, it is the object, in a way. It is the object, but it's not that kind of, it's musnad in rhetoric. So let me give you an example in English, what this all means, yeah? Mawdu'a, subject. So if I say al-insan, yeah, is human being, the human, yeah? In Greek logic, or let's just say even Islamic logic and stuff, they used to call this the human being, the rational being, or the haywan, or so rational animal. The rational animal. That's what they used to say. So if I say al-insan haywan natiq, the human being is a haywan natiq. It's basically the rational animal. The rational animal. Yeah? So the human is the rational animal. The human is the subject, which means what? Mawdu'a. The rational animal is the mahmul. That's the situation. It's a khabar. It's what he would be. Like, he is a rational animal. That is what he is. So if I say the human in this case, let's say Ali, right? That's the subject. Ali. The object, well, you call it the khabar or the mahmul here in the situation, is, let's say he's either dancing, or let's say he's sitting, yeah? Now, if I say he's dancing and sitting, and if it's the same time and place, you have a contradiction, yeah? But if I say he's if I change this, okay, he's sitting, Ali is sitting, Ali is dancing, is no problem. But if you have them both at the same time, you have a contradiction. Cannot be doing both at the same time. And place and relationally and all that kind of stuff, right? So you have to combine the conditions.
Yeah.
But effectively, that's what we're talking. That's the difference between a mahmool mawdu. I just want to make that very clear.
So the second condition is just that the khabar has to be the same. So you're talking about the same thing at the same time, same place, everything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if it is the same, then you have a contradiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you're saying he's standing and sitting at the same time, you have a contradiction.
Yeah. So it'd be Ali is standing, Ali is dancing.
Yeah.
Taking into account time and place.
Because I mentioned two different names, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That was the problem.
That was the problem, yeah. I'm just trying to get it because I know Mahmoud, when I was doing it, it was something to do with like, you got active and passive verbs.
No, be careful. Maf'ul. Maf'ul.
Yes.
Mabni ala al-majhul as well.
Yeah.
So in what do you call it? You've got maf'ul bihi, you've got maf'ul, you've got the fa'il, yeah. And then you've got mabni ala al-majhul. Mabni ala al-majhul is passive.
Yes.
So kutiba alaykum al-siyam wa huwa kurhun lakum.
Yeah, you're the hit, yeah.
Kutiba, that's passive now. Kutiba alaykum al-siyam is written, prescribed upon you the fasting, right? So that's passive.
Yeah.
If I say, katabtuhu alayk, I have prescribed it on you, or kataba ala nafsihi al-rahma, in the Quran, Allah has written upon himself mercy. Now that's active. Yani. So yeah, it's very similar sounds, yani, but it's different. Be careful, the some of the same things, yani, if you're studying Arabic grammar, one word means something different in rhetoric. It's the same word, but it means a different thing. Yani, the word sunnah has completely different connotations in hadith than is usul fiqh, that doesn't fiqh. So these are terminological words. Mahmul is a terminological word.
Yeah, okay.
Like qadiyya is very similar to al-khabar in, not al-khabar in nahu, al-khabar in rhetoric, which is a declarative statement. You've got the same word here being used. You've got mubtada and khabar in grammar. But the khabar means something different in rhetoric as it does in grammar. Okay. So you have to know the differences.
I think the word nahu as well has got like seven different...
Yeah, but that's different. I'm saying like these are key words. Do you know what I mean? So just be careful. When you're studying Islam, be careful of that stuff.
Yeah.
Even in propositional logic, it's you've got to be careful. Because some words that can be used in English propositional logic, they have a different meanings. Mm. Like for example, the word contingency. That's why I don't like... The reason why I don't like to use the word... I use the word dependency on purpose. Like in the book... The book. I use the word dependency because the word contingency has a connotation in propositional logic. I've read some in the books of logic, propositional logic.
You use both words in the book, right?
I do, but in the newest formulation, I'm using the word dependency now. And if I use contingency, I will caveat it and say this is what I mean by it and this is what I don't mean by it and all that kind of thing. Because for example, in propositional logic, someone could say, well, contingency means X, Y, and Z. It could be, it could not be, it could be, and you could have a false contingency, you could whatever, yeah? But I say, I'm not using it in that usage though. I'm using it in a completely different usage. So to try and avoid all that nonsense, I just say, okay, use the word dependency. It's not even a propositional term. Yeah. You're gonna find terms like, contingency in propositional logic. You'll not find terms like dependency in there, really.
Is that why you're writing about parts and about like, there's like seven different...
Yeah, yeah. So that's why I try and avoid terms which... Someone can do the fallacy of equivocation.
Yeah.
Effectively. And they say, well, you meant this, but you meant that, and you meant this, bro. And
yeah.
Bro, it's like...
That's what's happening in the book, right?
That happens everywhere, actually. Yeah. That's what they'll say, you meant that, and you meant this, and you... I mean, it's just, you know... just that's why I say, I try and do ilzam of someone. Use exactly the terms that I'm using and the language that I'm using. Because if you start importing your own language, then you can play around with it. That's what Ibn Taymiyyah was very, very careful with this kind of thing. He said, what do you mean by? And then he spent like a... Not in a Jordan Peterson sense, because that was it. Because even the word do, he said, Jordan Peterson, when he was speaking to me, he said, what do you mean by do? Do, I don't think do has a definition like that. It was like one of those things that it doesn't really, it's not, it's a kind of, I cannot remember the grammatical thing. But he became a postmodernist all of a sudden.
Also, his statement, what do you mean by do, is a self-defeating statement, because he's using the word do to ask the question itself. And then he doesn't understand, like, how ridiculous he sounds as well. He criticizes the postmodernist, but even not even Derrida would go that far. That's like extreme deconstruction.
That's a brilliant assessment. It's true. So, okay, let's get to it, guys. Because there's maybe one more thing we need to cover, which is called Al-Kulliyat Al-Khamsa. I don't know if we're going to cover it or not. If we do cover it, we've covered a lot. I'll look at this book again and see if there's anything that I ought to cover that I haven't covered. But do you not feel like you've come a long way? Do you not feel like you're armed with some serious...
A bit of refinement, but it's...
If someone now claims that you're contradicting yourself, who's the burden? The burden of proof is upon whom to show that? The one who's claiming this. If someone says you're contradicting yourself, say how? Sometimes by just asking someone to show how you're allegedly contradicting yourself, they will find it so difficult. That's it. Remember, asking questions is always safer than making the arguments. Yeah? Okay, so we'll give you like 10 minutes and then we'll come back. Do you guys want to present first? Do you want to present first? Yeah, go on.
Okay, we didn't really have much
sense. No problem. On the cuff. So we said that like...
An atheist argument.
So, how would you use proof of contradiction or like reductio arguments against, for example, an atheist?
I think we can go back to a basic, ultimate question, which is, can we have something that comes from nothing? Can something come from nothing? So I think.
No, but hey, is this reductio ad absurdum? Is this proof by contradiction?
I think there's one way we can do it, which is if we were to assume that something can come from nothing, then this would lead to absurdities in the real world.
How? What exactly?
Because it would mean that at any point in time, anything could happen. Or if I have, things saved somewhere, then that could go missing. It just leads to very different absurdities.
William Lane Craig-esque type rationalization. Yeah. I don't think it's wrong personally. I don't think this is wrong. Because if we assume you're saying, if they say yes, if not be here is something can not come from nothing. Because if we assume that something can come from nothing, then this... will lead to absurdities, which is that obviously a response to this and to William Lane Craig would be that we don't have nothing to play with here. How do we know if something can come from nothing or not? Because we're not dealing with nothing. Because he says that, for example, Craig would say, well, trees would pop out of nowhere. But is it really nowhere, someone could say, because we have cosmos and so on. So the argumentative burden is it's not as strong as, for example, what we were talking about before, right? Mm. But it's a very good attempt for sure. What else could you say? Let's use the verses of the Quran. Because the Quran does this, as we said. Okay, it does it quite regularly. And it does it to disprove polytheism in two distinct verses. Okay, maybe more. But two that I can think of in my mind. Let's recap just for 1 second, right? We said a contradiction in propositional terms is what?
Conflict of two declarative statements.
Okay. So how would you put that symbolically? Like
P and not P.
P and not P. It's a conjunction of the affirmation and its negation together in a sentence. A compound. Okay, no problem. So now we want to show that the opposite of what we want to affirm is true. So in other words, we want to argue... reductio. We want to disprove polytheism. What does the Quran say about this?
Different gods, different wills, competing wills.
Okay, how? Yani, do you the ayah or? Okay, the ayah is the following. Yeah, it's لو كان فيهما آلهة إلا الله لفسدتا. If they had been in them, the heavens and the earth, more than one god. Then it would have been corrupt. The universe would have been destroyed. Now consider the following. Why is that the case? Because if you have more than one ultimate will, what are the alternatives? Let's think about it. Let's use the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Father is all-powerful, the Son is all-powerful, and the Holy Spirit is all-powerful. Can the Father do something without the permission of the Son? Like, for example, this is... blue, right? Can the Father make this red? And the Holy Spirit wants it green, and the other one wants it white? Now, if you say, no, he cannot do this, yani, when you say cannot, meaning impossibility, which means the will of one ultimately caused something which would otherwise be possible to be impossible in relation to the other person of the Trinity. Which means there's been a supervention on one will on the other will, whether one wants it or not. Someone could argue, well, the wills will always unite. But that's not my question. My question is distinctly about possibility. Is it possible that the one will can be different to another will? If you say it's impossible, then possibility has been defined as a result of the combination of three wills. That's a Quranic argument. And it is the best argument one can think of. And it's a reductio argument, or in discrete mathematics, proved by contradiction. Can you see this thing? Like, for example, مَا اتَّخَذَ اللَّهُ مِنْ وَلَدٍ وَمَا كَانَ مَعْهُ مِنْ إِلَهِ إِذَنْ لَذَهَبَ كُلُّ إِلَهٍ بِمَا خَلَقَ وَلَا عَلَى بَعْضُهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ. Allah did not take any son, nor did he have any creator with him. If, this is very powerful, it's conditional. If, or, يعني, إذن, in the situation if, like hypothetically, إذن, if this, if we concede, if we concede to the point, لَذَهَبَ كُلُّ إِلَهٍ بِمَا خَلَقَ. Each ultimate creator would have taken what they ultimately created. And they would have outstripped one another for power. Which means there's two attributes being highlighted here. Creative capacity and power. And what we're saying here is you cannot have more than one ultimate creator. Because if you have, if the Father is all powerful, and let's say the Father is the creator, the ultimate creator. The Son is the ultimate creator and the Holy Spirit is the ultimate creator. Is it possible for one of them to be the ultimate creator without the supervention of one of the creative capacities on the other? If you say it's impossible, then one of the wills, one of the creative essences or personas has supervened on the other. So it's creating impossibilities for others. Yani the Father is creating an impossibility for the Son, and the Son is creating an impossibility for the Holy Spirit. And the same thing applies with power. Can there be more than one all-powerful? Well, if you say no because impossible, then the Father is creating impossibility for the Son, and the Son is creating impossibility for the Holy Spirit. That's in effect, we're saying, let's grant you your premise, let's go with it. These are Quranic arguments. And as for the arguments for God's existence, you know, all of them go back to one ayah in the Quran, which is, أَمْ خُلِقُوا مِنْ غَيْرِ شَيْءٍ هُمُ الْخَالِقُونَ. All of them go back to that. Everything goes back to that. I can guarantee you. Well, they're created from nothing. The impossibility of coming from nothing. It's kind of like what you were saying. Yeah, from absolute nothing. And actually, a good translation would be by nothing. From nothing, because Allah, but by nothing. أَمْ خُلِقُوا مِنْ غَيْرِ شَيْءٍ أَمْ هُمْ الْخَالِقُونَ. Or they, were they the creators of themselves? It's showing you, it's impossible. This is impossible, and this is impossible. Which is, I was reading to you guys, but I'll read it here. What Leibniz said. Very powerful. And obviously he believes in the principle of sufficient reason. And he mentions this in his book, Monadology, and the Ultimate Origination of Things. The Ultimate Origination of Things is the name of his book. Yeah. And this is taken from a secondary source material from Stanford. Yeah, he says, and beautiful, beautiful. I like the way he does this. Some will consider it to be blasphemous, but I like the way he does this. Suppose that God does not exist. Because if this is blasphemous, so saying that two gods exist, and then let's see what happens. Yani, there's nothing, there's no... If you, yani, Allah says in the Quran, لَوْ كَانَ فِيهِمَا أَلِهَةٌ إِلَّا اللَّهِ. It's an impossibility. But he still mentioned, huh? He still mentioned if there was more than one God, yani, this was what, this is the result. Gottfried Leibniz is using the same kind of argument, which is argumentum ad absurdum. He says, let's assume that the atheist position is true. Suppose God does not exist. I like that. It's a very good, you catch the attention of the atheist straight away. Let's say, okay, no problem. So well, this guy's coming to my way. Okay, let's see. I can enjoy myself. I can go to the pub. I can masturbate myself on the porn hubs. I can do this. I can whatever I'd like to do in my life. I don't have to think about that. Whatever he does for his living, pot noodles and all this. We can have pot noodles. You know, suppose that God does not exist. If God does not exist, then the only things that exist are contingent beings, with the entire series of contingent things have an explanation. The explanation of the entire series cannot be a member of the series, since then it would explain itself and no contingent thing is self-explanatory. Saying, look, exactly effectively how Ibn Sina is yani arguing, probably taking it from him somehow. Saying, look, is this thing, is it contingent or is it necessary? If it's contingent and you only have contingent things, then what's the explanation? Because remember, he believes, really and truly, he believes an explanation is a cause, yeah? His thing is a cause-based argument. Although, he does believe in a kind of occasionalism, by the way. But let's just for the sake of argument. And the word explanation and cause are inextricably linked. If you look at how they're defined. But let's just say for the sake of argument, he's effectively making the following argument. You cannot have a world with just things which are caused. Because if you have a world with just things that are caused, then you cannot explain such a world, because the explanatory buck must stop at a necessary being. The explanatory buck must stop at something which has no explanation. So he continues. I'll read out what he said. But the explanation cannot be outside the series, because we have assumed that there is no non-contingent being, i.e. God. Thus, if God did not exist, there would be something unexplained, the series of contingent things. Everything has an explanation. Okay, this is a very wide version of the PSR, because there are different versions. There's, he says everything has an explanation. Even he doesn't believe every single thing has an explanation. Every single thing. 2 + 2 = 4. It's a necessary fact. It doesn't have an explanation outside of itself. Someone could argue, and we've kind of been through this, but just to remind you, what's the difference between a necessary fact and a necessary being? Do you remember the answer for that? Now, necessary facts are in the category of facts, and beings or necessary existence in the category of existence. There's only one necessary existence, because it's in the category of existence. Yep. Do you get what I'm saying? Anyway, we don't have a problem with necessary facts. Necessary facts are not a problem for us. It's only in the category of existence. Where it has a substrate, this thing exists, has actual ontological status. Yes? Therefore, he says, therefore God exists alone. Notice the similarity of the, he's comparing him with Spinoza. Spinoza has a different idea, completely. I wouldn't even entertain Spinoza's God, that he believes. But for the sake of argument, the best arguments for God's existence entertain the opposing, in my opinion. They entertain it. Or the best arguments against polytheism entertain the opposing framework. This proof of by contradiction is one of the most powerful weapons for the Muslim in an intellectual setting. There's no doubt about that. So what we have been able to cover today is the following. We have covered the definition of contradiction. And in fact, we have covered more than one definition. Just to summarize. Who remembers Aristotle's definition of contradiction?
It's possible that the same thing.
Are you reading it word for word, or are you?
No, I'm paraphrasing it.
Because I don't remember it word for word. I'm relying on you.
word for word, it is impossible that the same thing can at the same time both belong and not belong to the subject in the same respect. Word for word.
And the same respect. This is a very important thing. And then we talked about the 8 conditions. Who remembers the 8 conditions?
Yeah, the 8 conditions, just go through all of them.
Yeah, go on.
Should I mention Arabic or...?
Whatever you like, but so long as you have a translation, yeah.
Yeah, so mawdu', the subject matter has to be the same. Mahmul, the predicate or the khabar, needs to be considered. Makan, was a man, the place and time.
So if it's different, then is there contradiction?
No.
No. If it's the same, is there contradiction?
Yes.
Yeah, it could be. Could be.
With the other conditions.
Yeah.
Al-idafa, considering the relationship between the subject matter and the relationship, so like father to son or son to father, it's not a contradiction if there's a relational difference. Then we looked at bilquwa and bilfi'l, so looking at the potential capability versus the actuality. So it's possible for two things to it's possible for someone to have the potential capability but not act upon it. Then we looked at the final one, which was the conditionality. So acknowledging if there's a condition that's been placed on a subject matter, then we need to also consider that if we're looking at if we're going to assume that that could lead to a contradiction.
Yeah, so if you cannot put one condition, it's opposite.
Yeah, okay.
Basically. Yeah. But the main thing is conflict. Salb wal ijab, affirmation and negation. The main thing is P and not P. That's the most jama' man I think you're going to hear. The most comprehensive thing, which is that you have a conjunction of things and it's, you cannot have its affirmation and its negation at the same time. You know? And as we said, consistency would dictate that there's no interpretation in which that can be the case. And with that, we will conclude. And I hope you are enjoying this as much as we are sharpening our tools, sharpening our saw, getting ready for the intellectual battle, actually continuing it. Because now, you know, I think we are a force to be reckoned with. Or as we said, the modus ponens way. If you are a member of the Sapiens Institute, then you are a force to be reckoned with. Hopefully now you're a member of the Sapiens Institute. Therefore, you'll be a force to be reckoned with. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.